this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I sit down with Brandon Peoples and his graduate student Josh Vine to discuss their work with the Atlantic sturgeon on the Savannah River. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Our guest today is Dr. Brandon Peoples. Brandon is an assistant professor at Clemson University's College of Agriculture, Forestry, and Life Science. His study interests cover a wide range, everything from tiny stream fishes to giant endangered sturgeons. He enjoys teaching and has taught courses in ichthyology, fisheries techniques, and a quantitative graduate course. Brandon's passion for teaching others doesn't reside solely in the classroom. He is also one of the co-writers for the Fisheries Blog, a source of popular articles and other short fisheries-related stories. Welcome to the podcast, Brandon.
Hello, it's good to be here. It's good to be part of such a fun science communication opportunity that you're working on.
Well, thank you. Brandon, you have a handful of interesting projects going on down there at Clemson. You sent me a list of three to choose from, and I'll admit I was a bit selfish in my selection. I spent a little time working with pallid, shovelnose, and lake sturgeon on the Mississippi River, and I have a personal interest with playing around with depth finders, specifically side imaging units. And you have a project that ties both of those together. So the choice is pretty obvious. And you've invited one of your graduate students to tag along on this adventure, Josh Vine. How are you?
I'm doing well, Nick. Thanks for having us here.
All right, Josh. What got you interested in coming to Clemson and studying Atlantic sturgeon?
I attended Clemson as an undergraduate student for 4 years. And during that time, I got into some fish work. And it actually just kind of led me into a job with the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources, working with Atlantic sturgeon, particularly some other diatomous fish. But, you know, I worked a couple of years down there, and I was fortunate enough for them to help me out, and they wanted to start a grad project up in Clemson, and I was happy to do it.
That seems like a pretty similar career path that I took to get to where I am now. You said you worked a little bit with Atlantic sturgeon, and that's what your master's project is on. So how would you describe the Atlantic sturgeon to someone who has never seen one?
So they're a really, really old species. Pretty closely related sharks. They're cartilaginous. They have a very similar structure as a shark. Like, if you look at their tails, they're both really big, very similar. They both have prominent dorsal fins. But one of the biggest differences between sharks and sturgeon is, you know, they don't have the teeth like sharks. And they've got like a subterminal mouth, meaning it's like a sucking mouth up under the front of their face. And they've got these little whiskers that, you know, that we call barbels. And those are part right there in front of the mouth. They're a pretty crazy looking fish.
Yeah, they really are. I have a little tiny shovel-nosed sturgeon that I keep in a jar of alcohol that I take around to show kids in Kansas, and they just can't believe that those are swimming in our waters.
Yeah, they're awesome fish for sure.
These sturgeon, the Atlantic sturgeon, they're described as diatomous. What does that mean?
Basically, it means they spend time in both fresh and salt water. Sturgeon are born in freshwater systems, so they make freshwater migrations that get to a suitable spawning substrate. And then when they grow up, they become subadults, they'll make offshore migrations to kind of accumulate energy so they can return to those freshwater systems when they're mature adults to spawn.
And these sturgeon are a federally endangered species. What are some of the factors that have led to that?
So sturgeon were actually one of the biggest things. They were pretty exploited early on in like the early 1900s, basically because they were the original source of caviar. We targeted these species on their spawning migration. So anytime you do that, you know, you're not going to have a very good time. And these fish are very late maturing species. So sometimes it'll take up to 15 years for some of these individuals to become mature. So it's difficult for these populations to recover, I guess. But also, you know, we have put up dams and a lot of dredging efforts. Basically, a lot of the issues reside within habitat alteration.
Like you said, one of the best times to sample these fish is while they're making their spawning runs, and that can add some unwanted stress to an already stressed fish. And I hinted at it, but you guys are using a slightly different technique to get an estimate on the number of these endangered fish. So how are you guys doing that?
So we use a fancy recreational grade side scan sonar unit. We particularly use the Hummingbird Helix 12. So it's a big 12-inch screen. It's got some really good imaging abilities. And basically, we just sampled down the river and ran these depth finders.
So you just went down to the nearest Bass Pro and picked up a Hummingbird unit, and now you're studying sturgeon with it.
Well, not exactly. We had some of my colleagues talk to some of the Hummingbird experts, and they let us believe that some of the technology that they were using was top of the line and also, you know, relatively inexpensive. I want to say that it was, when it first came out, it was roughly $2,500. And I personally know a few bass fishermen that have two of these on their boats. So it's really, really fair price for what you get.
Now, I have a Helix unit on my personal boat, but it's only a 5-inch screen, so it's a little smaller than the one you're working with.
Yeah, we had some fancy equipment. We use this recreational grade unit because we were working in the upper section of the Savannah River. It's a little bit shallower, and we weren't necessarily able to use some of the higher technology equipment like a tow behind unit. Those tend to have to be towed in a little bit deeper water. And some of the times we were sampling the river, we were, you know, almost scraping the bottom. So it was really nice to have a unit that we didn't have to tow. It was just the transducer was just mounted to the back of the boat.
A few years ago, I sat in on a presentation about some similar work being done up in the Northwest with white sturgeon. And their fish were very, very easy to identify, even from the shadows that these fish will give off in the side imaging. Are Atlantic sturgeon pretty easy to distinguish from other fish in the Savannah River when you're looking at your side scan data?
Yeah, I believe the fish are pretty easy to identify. It took a little bit of time for me initially because I had to kind of get my bearings straight on scale. The marks that we're looking at for these sturgeon are, you know, they're a lot smaller than what you would originally expect. But once I started seeing fish in my files, I got pretty used to it. They really do produce a prominent shadow where you can see that shark-like tail. It's pretty easy to identify them.
Then, so how do you get from taking the data on the Hummingbird unit and taking it into your computer to look at later?
Okay, so we use a SD card. We use a Class 10 SD card. We installed it in the front of the Hummingbird unit, and you can actually record stuff with this unit. So we basically start going downriver, press record, and record every 15 minutes, then start a new file. So we had 15-minute recordings, and we take them back into the office and load them into software called Sonar TRX. And when we upload those files into Sonar TRX, I could literally scroll through it as if I was scrolling through a book on my computer, and I can look through each file and count each sturgeon, and I can actually even export these tracks, these recordings, onto Google Earth and observe where these fish actually were in the river.
So another thing with side imaging sonar is you can kind of get an idea of bottom hardness based off the way the reflection comes back off of the side scanning. Are you looking at any of the substrate that these sturgeon are associated with?
I'm definitely looking just for my own knowledge, but we're not necessarily doing any of that substrate for our current project. But I do notice that sturgeon tend to be a little bit closer to structure from what I've seen, especially around deep holes. They like to get around riprap on the sides and some really big like root balls that are present in the, like in and around the channel and the river.
And one of the things that we will be doing in the future is once we really get a good handle on where these aggregations of sturgeon are, we'll be able to go back and look at our sonar files and determine the substrate hardness and actually go back out and ground truth that so we can get a little bit better idea about the microhabitat characteristics of what they're spawning on in Savannah.
So I know when I drive around with my side imaging unit, I'm usually just looking for brush piles and stuff. But sometimes you come across some more interesting finds. One time I found an old boat motor that fell off someone's boat. Have you found anything interesting while you're out there driving around the Savannah River?
Not anything too interesting. You know, it was kind of disheartening to see the amount of tires that I saw on side scan sonar, but there were a few instances where, you know, my eyes might have been playing tricks on me, but after looking at these files, you see things that look like old boats, like old shipwrecks. I wasn't able to actually truth that, but there were a couple things that I thought I saw, but like I said, your eyes can play tricks on you when you're looking at sonar files all the time.
Oh, definitely. My old boat motor that I thought I found, I measured it. I used HumViewer and I measured it and it said it was about 10 feet long. So I doubt that's about it. So based on your work so far, how do the Atlantic sturgeon look? Is there reason for hope? Are they bouncing back or are they still kind of in the decline?
I like to hope that they're bouncing back. So what we did, we basically estimated a single season spawning run. We saw a fair amount of fish come up river, but, you know, obviously we didn't see as much as we were hoping for. It's one of those things where it's just a single season estimate that we have. These fish only make migrations sometimes every 3 to 5 years. So we need to keep the project that I'm doing ongoing for another 3 to 5 years, I would say, before we could really come up with strong estimates as to the populations during the savannah. That being said, we did see a fair amount of adults come up. You know, we have high hopes that it's going to keep getting better every year.
One problem is that there's not really a lot to compare it to because it's easier to estimate the number of adults because, you know, they're coastal, they're hanging out in the estuary areas in denser groups. We can catch those and do traditional capture mark recapture methods during times of their life when they're not quite as sensitive. But, you know, when you have these big 10-foot fish plus running up these rivers, catching them in 5 feet deep of water when they're trying to make a spawning run, it's really hard on them. And so that's when you don't have a lot of good estimates of number of spawning adults every year in many rivers because it's hard to do and it's hard on the fish. When a fish is federally endangered, you don't want to put any undue stress on it and studying it. So that's why these side scan approaches are becoming more and more popular, because we can do that simply just by driving down the river and counting these fish that way, and we don't have to lay hands on them. So we're hoping to see more of these type studies come forward so we can be able to actually make that kind of call. Are they doing better? Are they on the decline? Getting that data that we can actually scientifically say that for sure.
Is the Savannah River one of the main rivers that these fish use, or is it just the main river you guys are using in your study?
So sturgeon use basically every large river in South Carolina, any river that's not necessarily 100% coastal. The Savannah River has a strong population in comparison to other rivers, but there are some more natural rivers that contain what we think contain higher populations. The Edisto River has a pretty solid population, and the Petey River has a pretty solid population. Like we said earlier, we don't know too much about the health of the Savannah River population, but we're just kind of trying to get familiar with the new technology and kind of set like a baseline for how we can really get a hand on sampling these adult populations.
Yeah, what we're really hoping to do is use our work in the Savannah, not just with the side scan technology, but also with the statistical analyses that we're doing as kind of a model, as a pilot study, to develop more of a statewide monitoring program of adult sturgeons that we can monitor effectively and analyze more effectively. So stay tuned for more things from other rivers, at least in South Carolina.
Josh, I kind of inferred from some of your answers that you just finished the first year of your master's work. Do you have anything additional planned for your second year? Are you adding on to your project or just going along with driving your boat down the river, scanning sturgeon?
Well, so I'm actually finishing up my second year of my graduate degree right now. I'm in my fifth semester, or I guess I'm in my fifth semester, so a little over 2 years. I actually wasn't able to get out in the field my first season, so I spent this last year's fall and summer actually collecting data. And as you can imagine, it takes quite a while to look through all these sonar files. So it took a large amount of my last year to analyze these. But I'm currently trying to finalize everything, try to get the adult migration estimates out for the Savannah River. And hopefully we can pass another project on to somebody else. They can keep doing what we're doing.
Well, Josh, thank you for filling us in on your graduate project, and best of luck to you in the future on defending your thesis and finding a job. But now we're going to have a little fun and do a little quiz to see who the real expert about Atlantic sturgeon is, Brandon or Josh.
All right.
So the game is set up just like the old card
show. It's me versus Josh?
Yep, it's Brandon versus Josh.
Oh, going Josh, down. You're going to kill me. Yeah, you're the sturgeon expert.
We'll see.
So the game is set up just like the old show Card Sharks. So I'll alternate asking one of you a question about Atlantic sturgeon characteristics, such as how old they get, and then the other will answer higher or lower. and it's pretty easy to play along. All these numbers are taken from fishbase.org. So this is what the information on that website was. I can't get vouch for the local accuracy that you guys see on the in South Carolina, but that's what I got.
That's all right. I understand.
You guys care who goes first on this one?
We're going to flip a coin?
I guess I don't have a coin. We can just say
no,
Josh
I'm
goes
just
first.
I'm just kidding. I'll go first.
Yeah, Josh can go first.
All right, Josh. What is the maximum reported age of an Atlantic sturgeon?
I want to say the maximum recorded age is 80 years.
Brandon, higher or lower?
I'll say lower.
The maximum reported age on fishbase.org is 60 years old.
Ooh.
So Brandon gets the point there.
That's still pretty old.
Yeah, you said they're a long-lived species. 60 years, that's pretty old for a fish. They've seen some stuff.
That is an old fish.
Yeah.
So, Brandon, what is the maximum length of an Atlantic sturgeon?
Maximum length? I'll say 450 centimeters.
I'm gonna say lower for that one.
Maximum length on a fish base is 430 centimeters for a female or 403 for a male. So that's about 13, 14 feet.
That was close.
Pretty close.
I didn't know they'd been recorded that large.
Josh, what is the diameter of an Atlantic sturgeon egg?
Ooh, let's go with 2 millimeters.
Brandon, higher or lower?
Are we talking about in the fish or once it's been spawned and has filled up with water?
That I don't know.
Are you just going off fish bait? 2 millimeters? Oh, gosh. I'll say higher.
Pretty close there, Josh. It was 2.55 millimeters, or about a tenth of an inch.
That rounds up to 3, I guess, so I think I lost that one, too.
Brandon, how many small scutes are present between the anal fin and the caudal fulcrum?
Between the anal fin and the caudal fulcrum, I'll say 4.
Sorry, Josh, you hit it right on the head there. He got 4.
No,
that's
really?
All right.
It's a little out of reach, but just for fun, how many pairs of barbels do Atlantic sturgeon have?
Well, I want to say it could vary, but I'm going to say four.
So how many pairs of barbels is it?
Oh, pairs. Okay. Well, then I guess I got to go with 2 since I said 4.
It is 2 okay. pairs of barbels on it. Atlantic sturgeon. So
very nice.
You were a little hesitant, but it turns out you are the Atlantic sturgeon expert.
I don't know. I think Josh could still bring out a few that I wouldn't know.
That's all right. You're the winner today.
Yeah, you guys will have to fight about that in the lab tomorrow. And as I mentioned, all these numbers were taken from fishbase.org, and this is a large free source of information for an abundance of fish. And they recently faced some funding issues and have fortunately received about 90% of the funds necessary to cover their 2018 funding gap and secure their 2019 funding. So if you use this website and gather information, or if you would just like to help out, head on over and help them gather that final 10% of their funds by clicking the link on the top banner of their webpage. So now we're down to the final 5 questions, and this is a group of 5 questions that I ask each of the expert guests that come on the show. And we'll alternate between Brandon and Josh for both of these. And we start real simple with what is your favorite fish? Brandon, you can go first.
My favorite fish is actually a fish that I have not gotten yet to study formally. And I kind of like that. It's the bowfin, Amia calva. My favorite fish is the bowfin. I didn't have any particular affinity for bowfin until whenever I was a freshman in college. And I used to take care of our 500 gallon aquarium, and one day I was being silly or whatever, stuck my finger in there, and the bowfin immediately came up and just ripped me a pretty good gash on one of my fingers. And after that, I had a lot of respect for that fish, and I started learning about it, and there's so many cool things about this fish, the bowfin, and I've been fascinated with it ever since.
All right, Josh, how about you?
Well, I think I'm going to be a little corny here and have to say my favorite fish is the Atlantic sturgeon. I'm just, I guess, having been paying so much attention to what's going on with them in the past 4 years, I just, you know, I really respect them as a species, and I think they're really, really cool. And also being able to catch and handle some of those adults and some of those tiny little juveniles, it's really awesome to get your hands on them. You realize how prehistoric they really are.
Josh, we'll just continue on with you. What is your favorite memory from your career thus far?
My favorite memory. You know, I think my favorite memory probably came from the first time I actually caught an adult sturgeon in a gill net in the wild. We were setting nets in the Santee River in South Carolina and setting gill nets, and we were pulling it in and we felt a pretty solid tug on the net, and we had spent a lot of time not catching fish. Anybody that set gill nets knows how that is. So to feel something tug in the net was quite a surprise, and then to see the size of the fish was even better. And I was, you know, just starting as a technician at South Carolina DNR at that point in time. But that was probably one of the most exciting moments that I've had in my career so far.
Brandon, you've been around for just a few more years longer than Josh. What's been your favorite memory so far?
I don't know if it's a memory specifically, but it's kind of a feeling right around whenever I got my first paper accepted into a scientific journal. It's kind of the point where I realized that, okay, you know, you went from, okay, I'm just standing on this riverbank watching fish spawn, you know, taking notes. Really anybody can do this. You know, you read these scientific papers, they're so technically written, and they're written by all these names of people that you see that are somewhat famous. And you realize that, well, you know, this really is for everybody. Anybody can do science if you just kind of train your mind to think a certain way and are disciplined about it. So it kind of demystified the whole scientific process. And it really helped me kind of be confident as a person who studies nature and just loves fish.
Brandon, you're probably already in it, but what is your dream job or dream location?
Yeah. Definitely what I'm doing now is a realized dream job. You know, I never started out thinking that I wanted to even get a master's, let alone a PhD. You know, when I started out, I didn't dream of being a professor. But as time went on, you know, I really just realized that this is what I'm supposed to be doing out here in the world. And I think kind of realizing that when it all kind of opens up, it's a good feeling. And so now that I'm here, just being able to do my research and work with great students like Josh and the rest of our folks here, it really is a dream come true. And definitely this is a dream location. You know, I live and work in the southeastern United States, which is the hub of freshwater biodiversity in North America. And so if you like studying fish diversity, there's anything that you want is within a couple hours drive of here. Amazing, you know, ridiculously looking painted darters and minnows, all the way to these endemic black bass that we have, to, you know, gigantic sturgeon that make massive migrations along the coast and up our river. The southeast is a great place to be.
Josh, you're going to be starting to look for jobs here pretty soon. What would be your dream job or dream location to work in?
That's a tough question, but I think currently I got really interested. I was attending the American Fisheries Society National Meeting in Atlantic City, and I was able to attend this presentation on sawfish. And it seemed kind of like they were kind of like sturgeon in that, you know, we don't really have too much information about what they do and where they spend their time. Watching that presentation, I really, really started getting interested in the research that's going on with them. And, you know, just so happens they like to spend some time in the Bahamas. So that would be a pretty sweet place to work as well. but sawfish are pretty cool species, and definitely something I want to start looking more into.
Are you looking for going straight for a full-time job, or are you interested in getting your PhD and becoming a professor or a top-notch researcher?
Well, I definitely want to be a top-notch researcher, but I don't really know where I'm going to be yet. I think at this point in my life, I kind of would like to get back into a career, get into a job and actually get my hands on some fish. I've spent quite a bit of time, just like all these other graduate students out there, with my hands on my computer and my eyes on books and journal articles. So I really, really think I need to spend a couple more years out in the field, get some more inspiration, and then, you know, wherever my life leads me after that, whether it's PhD or, you know, whatever, either way, I definitely am going to be in the research world.
If you're interested in research, I'm sure you have a little bit of an idea, but if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
So I've always been interested in what these adult sturgeon are doing offshore when they're not attempting spawning migrations. It just happens that, you know, these fish come into our rivers and it makes them more accessible to us. We've been putting Vimco transmitters, acoustic transmitters, and fit in these sturgeon for a while now, tracking their movements, but there's still some big gaps as to what they're doing offshore. If I had a boatload of money, I might invest it into some cool telemetry receiver arrays in the offshore, and we can figure out really where these fish are aggregating at different times of the year and try to figure out their offshore movement patterns. I think that'd be some really insightful information for all the rivers that are wondering, all the people that are doing research in the rivers.
Brandon, same question to you. If you had all the money in the world, what is one project you'd want to work on?
All of them. You know, especially in the southeastern U.S., but throughout North America, we have this amazing fish diversity. And it is absolutely surprising how little we know about these fish that we have. Even with excellent resources like FishBase and the Fish Trades database that put that information out there, there are still really large gaps in some of our basic life history knowledge of even the most common species. But by studying common species, fish that just live everywhere that we kind of look over, we say they're not really interesting. There's everything, you know, they're everywhere. In doing that, you know, we often find really interesting gems about these fish that can kind of lead us to deeper things. But unfortunately, you know, funding for that kind of thing it's rare, right? And we have urgent things to deal with. We have to figure out how to keep sturgeon on the planet. You know, we have to figure out how to not overfish our resources. Those are super urgent issues. But I would just love to be able to have like a coordinated research group, a bunch of collaborators across the country that was just devoted to studying the basic life history of fishes, studying reproduction, diets, age and growth, putting that into a big database and just seeing what kind of patterns that we can come across and come up with, and just filling in those gaps in the basic things. We think we've moved on, but there's still a lot for us to learn just in the streams really close to home.
Final question for both of you is, if there is one point or principle that you could have programmed into everybody's head, what would it be? Well, we can start with Josh on this one.
That's a good question there. Let's see here. So if I could program something in anybody's head, I honestly like honesty is obviously going to be a top one up there. I don't ever like to deal with anybody that is dishonest, especially in science. A lot of stuff can go wrong when people start being dishonest, especially with data. So honestly, you know, it's kind of one of those corny answers, but I think that's pretty high up there.
That's a good, simple, whole overarching answer that I think a lot of people would respect. Brandon, what would be your one point or principle?
Well, for me, I would say, at least from a scientific perspective, I think that it's really important to try to wash your research of any like implicit bias that you might have. Especially, you know, I'm an angler. A lot of us oftentimes feel like we already have the answer to the question. You know, I know this fish, I know what it's doing. And so it's easy to bring in assumptions to a certain study or a specific management problem. But oftentimes, you know, the data might tell a different story. So being as objective as possible when you're going about doing any kind of fishery study and following the data, being intuitive, of course, you know, being smarter than your data, but also believing your data when it says something that might be contrary to what you thought about before. So staying objective and being objective in your communication with the public and open and honest about that, I think is really important.
Well, Josh and Brandon, thank you for coming on the podcast today. I enjoyed hearing about you and your work with Atlantic Sturgeon. Now, I'm sure we'll have one or both of you or a different student on again in the future to discuss some other projects. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of either of you, how would they do that?
You can send us just a good old-fashioned email at Peoples, that's my last name, P-E-O-P-L-E-S, at clemson.edu.
Yeah, and it'd probably be the best way to contact me as well. My email is jvine@g.clemson.edu.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at fisheriespod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Tune in next week when we will have a special Columbus Day episode. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 6th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, be honest and avoid having bias with your research.